We're getting jazzy here on Canucks Talk. Welcome back here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz live.
We're just
from
trolling
the Kintec
now,
studio.
Right?
Trolling you. Yeah.
Formless noodling. I hate jazz.
650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber in Ladner has moved
Let's
to Progress Way.
This, in Tilbury.
Jazz is the... Oh, wait. I'm doing the old
Let
Dunbar Lumber
read.
I'm doing the old one. Dang it.
Jazz is not good.
650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com.
Okay, Thomas, what kind of childhood trauma is associated with your hate of jazz?
None. I just don't like it. I don't like it at all.
What's your stance on jazz, Dom?
I love jazz.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
That makes
like
so
actually,
sense.
Or are you joking?
Wait, hold on. One moment, Jamie. What do you mean, Thomas?
You're exactly the guy
That's
I think of.
That's not
like,
true at all. That Dom is exactly the guy you'd expect to like jazz?
No, not like jazz, like someone who respectable who likes jazz and is just wrong.
I used to fall asleep listening to CBC under my pillow. I had jazz music.
I'm on. Thinking of Dom as someone like driving selfishly and going like, bibbidi-doo-ba.
Is that your stereotype of a jazz fan?
One of those things 100%. Is correct, and it's not the driving selfishly.
Every time I see someone make a jerk move on the road, I'm like, they're definitely listening
classic,
to Miles
classic
Davis.
Classic Dom move.
I'm a great driver.
I'm legitimately stunned that you like jazz. I would not
really?
Have guessed that in a million years, that Dom likes jazz. I know there's nothing.
I like many things.
There's no value judgment attached to that, good or bad. I'm just very surprised. I thought you were a house music all the way guy.
I like multiple genres.
There's
for
jazz
you.
House, Jamie.
Yeah, there's jazz house.
Okay, we got to hear
Next
some of that.
Segment,
yeah, we got to hear some of that coming back.
We do not need to play any more jazz, guys. We're all jazzed out here.
You know what? It's good to have layers. It's good to have different interests. It is. No, I'm being serious.
I'm like
this
a seven-layer dip, Jamie.
Yeah. No, you gotta. It's good to have a diverse interest. So kudos to you, Dom. I don't often say it on the show, but kudos to you.
Thank you.
All right. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Looking ahead to the game tonight, or in just a few hours, really, this afternoon here out on the West Coast, Canucks and the Bruins. Interesting. You know, you brought up the under. The over-under of a total 5.5, right? The Bruins have had major problems scoring goals this year. And then you also factor in that there may be a defensive effort that they've got under Joe Sacco so far in their first couple of games.
Four goals in their last two games. And yet, I don't know. I feel like it's pretty... even when this Canucks team plays good defense, and I thought they played great defense against the Senators, it ends up being a 7-goal
game. A 4-3 game. Yeah. But it does feel like against the Bruins have had trouble to score, maybe refocusing on their defensive identity, a chance for the Canucks to continue to build on their defensive identity a little bit as well, even, you know, shorthanded as they are still with JT Miller out of the lineup.
Maybe it's a game where if you like the Bruins, right, you bet the Bruins money line and parlay it with the under. And if you like the Canucks, you bet the Canucks and parlay it
with the over.
It might be one of those.
Yeah, I can see that.
Where if the game gets free flowing and offense starts to sort of roll, goals start to be scored, that probably favors Vancouver.
My other take tonight on the game is expect a big performance from Quinn Hughes. An extremely well-rested Quinn Hughes who got kicked out of the game very harshly, ultimately the correct call based on how the rule is written, but really unlucky as well. He's played, 5 minutes of hockey in the last week? Quinn Hughes? Oh, how often does Quinn Hughes get that much rest during the season, right? Because they played last Tuesday. They played a week ago. 3 days off. Then he played 5 minutes or whatever in Ottawa.
Thanks, refs.
And then he got a couple of days off. Like, he's got to be just, like, raring to go.
Yeah.
Well-rested. I think a monster Quinn Hughes game is going to be on tap here for the Canucks.
And he can skate all day when he's tired.
Anyways. Yeah.
Hey, thanks, refs. Maybe that's a huge edge, especially going into a back-to-back set. You know, the blue line to me is a big story tonight because I do think they were about to make significant changes and we just never got a chance to see them because of what happened, because of the misconduct that Quinn Hughes took for that hit behind at the back of for boarding Josh Norris. So I'm really curious to see, like, are we going to see Brännström play top 4 minutes? Are we going to see Brännström play with Tyler Myers? Are we going to see Brännström matched up against top six competition at a far higher rate than he has been for most of this season? You know, to me, that's like probably the thing I'm most curious about this particular game. I'm really fascinated to see exactly how the Canucks are going to deploy their blue line coming out of Ottawa.
Yeah, and it's an interesting matchup for that as well, right? And I don't want to do the thing where we're, you know, super downplaying the Bruins' offensive talent, right? Obviously, there's still good players. There's still dangerous players in the lineup. But you have David Pastrnak skating on the top line, right, with Zacha and Geeky. And then Marchand, Lindholm, and Brazeau are on the second line. And, you know, Pastrnak, maybe his production has slipped a little bit this year, but still one of the most dangerous scorers in the NHL, right? So that's a very tough matchup inherently for whatever defensive pair is out there against Pastrnak. But, you know, Marchand and Lindholm, both very good players, but at this stage of their careers, are they dynamic offensive threats? Not necessarily, right? So it is a kind of thing where I like Brännström, maybe this is a situation where you can ease him into top 6 minutes a little bit, right? There's not the multiple super dangerous offensive lines at the top of the other team's lineup. Now, watch, I'll say this, and then Lindholm will go out and have a hat trick or something, and Marchand will dazzle or something because I'm setting it up and I'm jinxing the team. But it seems like a situation where you could tinker a little bit, right, and be maybe a little less nervous about increasing Brännström's responsibility. The other thing I think is this is just an opportunity for Carson Soucy and Tyler Myers, whether they're paired together or not. I thought they both played really well in Ottawa, right? You know, we talked about Tyler Myers breaking up that play in the neutral zone, jump-starting the offense that leads to a goal, leads to a rush goal, going the other way. Certainly from an underlying numbers perspective, it was Carson Soucy's best game in a while. That's still a really big deal, right? Yes, we're waiting on this team to potentially add somebody on the blue line at some point. We all expect them to. We're asking questions about, can they increase Eric Brännström's usage? Should they split up Hughes and Hronek? All of those things. The most straightforward, the easiest, the path with the least headaches to improving the blue line is just Carson Soucy and Tyler Myers get somewhere close to the performances they were giving you last year, right? Maybe that was the start of it against Ottawa. I think this is another opportunity for them to keep growing back into that type of role, that type of performance, and that's a really high-stakes thing for this team. Like Carson Soucy especially. The drop-off from Soucy from last year to this year, it's just been so extreme. It's almost inexplicable. And I think we've almost started to forget what an effective defender he can be when he's at his best. And like, even if they do make a trade and add someone, they still need Carson Soucy to be a lot better than he's been overall. Like, that's a really high stakes thing for this team, whether he can get back to that level of performance.
Yeah. Although, I mean, you do. I'm not sorry. I don't want to downplay that you do. I just want to note that if you are able to change his role, if Carson Soucy is playing Eric Brännström's minutes, now ideally with a more mobile partner than what Desharnais or Juulsen can offer, but if he goes into a third pair role, he's going to find his game. I'm very confident about that. Like, I think what's going on is partly that where Soucy's being deployed, the way, what's counted, what the Canucks count on their second pair to accomplish has just been outside where his game's at now. That's not to say it always will be. It's just clearly sort of snowballed against him, I think.
Yep.
One of those situations where it's bad, it doesn't get better, and then there's a confidence
then
issue.
You're thinking
and
about
snowballs
it.
And, you know, one mistake after the other, and maybe both him and Myers have been like 5% off, but then as a pair, you're way off. You know, and I just think it's one of those
Your partner's
things.
Not lifting you up or anything, right?
And you're struggling together and you just kind of can't get out of it. You know, like what sometimes happens to us in segments. That's sort of where I think they're at as a group here. And, you know, I do think if you're able to scale back his minutes, you're going to see improvement right off the hop, even if you don't have the ideal like right-handed puck mover to play him.
And that can be a start of the baby steps to getting him back, right? Because if it's a confidence issue and you dial back his responsibility a little bit, and I don't think it has to be. Because I think back to last year and the defensive usage, and I don't have the numbers or the minutes are in front of me or anything like that, right? But when it was Soucy, Myers and Zadorov, Cole, it wasn't really a second pair, third pairing situation. Now, maybe it got to that point in the playoffs where it was really a hard match, you know, Soucy, Myers against Connor McDavid. But for the regular season, it was more like we kind of have two and a half pairs. You know what I mean? Like we have pair 2A and pair 2B, or pair 3A and 3B, if you want to be more pessimistic, with those two pairs. And it was a little more even. And I wonder if because I do think it would be too much of a jump just to go, you know, straight top four, consistent top six matchups for Eric Brandstrom. But is there just a bit of a happy medium for both pairings, right? Where you dial it a little bit up, but not all the way to, you know, hardcore top four usage for Brandstrom, and dial it a little bit down for Soucy and Myers. And then you kind of see where it goes, right? Because maybe that's part of getting Soucy back to his game. You ease the burden a little bit, help him build his confidence, help him feel good, and then you can dial it back up as the season goes along. But I think when they were playing their best defensive hockey last year, it was a much more even usage, I think, between the bottom two defensive pairs. They didn't have to rely on one to soak up all those tough matchups. Maybe now they do, with the way the roster is constructed, with some of the personnel they have on the blue line. But if they could get back to that, I think it could go a long way to helping Carson Soucy as well.
Yeah. Look, I think you're right. And look, I just think we need to see more Brandstrom. We just need to see more
Brandstrom. The answer is always more Brandstrom.
It's not always more Brandstrom, but it is right now. I mean, it's at the very least, like, you can't have one guy playing at the level that he has for this protracted a period of time while your second pair struggles,
mm-hmm.
and not
try even more minutes.
And by the way, that's not to say that it's not reasonable to be skeptical about what Brandstrom can do,
mm-hmm.
as his usage ticks up, as he makes that difficult step from being sheltered third pair puck mover to being a top four guy battling, realistically, if you're playing second pair minutes, guess what? You're going to spend 5 minutes on the ice against David Pastrnak tonight. That's tough, right? Like, that is materially different than how Brandstrom has been used for the majority of the season, but his performance warrants it. Like, it can't be clearer. I've almost never seen a more extreme example, to be totally honest with you, of a player crushing it while a line above him struggles, and we just don't see it change at all. Like, the only reasons, if you go graph it out, I did it at The Athletic yesterday, if you want to go read the notebook from yesterday. I graphed it out, and it's just like, the only time that you will see any Canucks defender's ice time significantly change is like when Tyler Myers leaves in the first period with what looks like a gruesome, you know, high ankle sprain,
yep.
that he luckily doesn't cause him to miss a single game beyond the rest of that one. Or Quinn Hughes getting a misconduct, right? Like, this team has been remarkably steady in terms of their blue line deployment. And fair enough, they've performed reasonably well from a results perspective. They've certainly had a high floor despite a lot of things not going their way. But they've been completely unwilling to even try and find solutions to the second pair issue, which I think has been clear as day even when the club was like rolling earlier on the season. Like, with the exception of that California trip, and I think one of the reasons the California trip stands out to us is that the Myers-Soucy pair had a strong run.
A good
run.
Performance, absolutely.
And
it totally changes how the team looks when they're just reliable, right?
The defense looks locked in a totally different way in those minutes. So, you know, I'm just shocked that it's taken this long, and I'll be fascinated to see exactly what the ice time looks like, the deployment looks like, and the pairings look like this evening.
Yeah, and Armchair Canucks text in 650, 650 here. You can text in as well to the Dunbar Lumber text line. He says, putting Brandstrom with Hughes is exactly how you move him up while protecting him from getting crushed. And it's one of those things, and I mean, we don't have to belabor the Hughes-Hronik stuff too much here. We've gotten into that plenty, but it's one of those things where it's like, I have no doubt that Hughes and Brandstrom would work well together, right? Because Hughes and pretty much everyone works well together. And Brandstrom has that puck-moving ability to complement what Quinn Hughes is able to do as well. You'd still have your other more traditional shutdown guys that you could use maybe against top competition too. We all know also Hughes is going to cycle through partners at different times in the game. So I'd be open to that. And maybe that's part of increasing Brandstrom's minutes without doing a full-on shuffle on the blue line, right? Is, remember, I think it was back to the beginning of last year where it was going to be, hey, we're going to be defense by committee. We're going to move guys around during the game, right? Can you find opportunities to do that? To move Hronik down, get him some shifts with Carson Soucy here or there, but he's still mostly paired with Quinn Hughes. And then you get Eric Brandstrom up to take some shifts, bump his minutes up that way. And again, as the texter says, in relatively safer minutes, right? Where he's got Quinn Hughes out there to do a large part of the work with him as well. I don't know. It's worth talking about. And I think what we're getting at here is you're in a situation where Brandstrom, if you want to take them, and they might be unconventional, but at least he gives you some options. At least he gives you some different things to try, right? Whether it's moving him to the right side, playing him with Hughes, whether it's simply a matter of increasing his minutes, whether it's shuffling your defensive pairs, whatever the case is, he gives you some legitimate options that maybe you wouldn't have if Brännström hadn't popped like this so far, or at least performed like this. Popped might be. Would you say he's popped?
I mean, relative to expectations.
Yeah.
But the expectations
were extremely low.
Yeah, even internally, right? And that's, you know, like, we talk a lot about the Canucks' pro scouting finds.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think we can lump Brännström in with them. Like, Brännström was acquired because his cap hit was a perfect match for what the Avalanche needed to get a perfect capture when they acquired Tucker Pullman, provided that the Canucks retain the exact percentage of Tucker Pullman's contract that they did.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was a math equation. And Brännström had come in as a free agent and not impressed them at training camp, and they were willing to cut bait. And he came into Vancouver, and Patrick Alvin was like, we discussed him as a possibility this summer, and yeah, I mean, he's here. And then they placed him on waivers the exact same day. And credit to him. Like, he went down to Abbotsford and just could do whatever he wanted. He had mm-hmm. 3 points in 2 games and was completely dominant. And the Canucks said, hey, we can't move the puck right now. Let's get him up here. And to their credit, they quickly, I think, changed gears.
That's where the credit comes in for
that's
me.
Where, yeah.
Is like, what do you play, 2 games in Abbotsford? Yeah. And they're like, oh, okay, maybe this guy can help us, at least in the short term, right?
Maybe he brings something we need. And look, it was so obvious. I mean, go watch the highlights of his two Abbotsford Canucks games, and it's just like, he's all over the ice. It was completely ridiculous. It's just, he's way too good for the American League level. He might be too good for the third pair. I don't know that, by the way. I'm not planting my flag on Brännström as like, on a Gustav Forsling glow up track or anything by any means, but you know, I've liked him over the years. I think there's game there, and I think his performance just very clearly warrants being bumped up the lineup. And you got to see it. You got to see it before you pay assets to acquire a blue liner. Like, you have to know.
You want to know what you have.
You want to know. You want to at least give him 10 games.
Yeah.
You want to at least give him 3 weeks. You want to give him 3 weeks facing relatively normal second pair competition so that you know what you need.
I just think, even if you do that, does it really change what you're looking for, though? Like, even if you do that, okay, you give him the 3 weeks second pair minutes and he does well, don't you still want to go out and get another defenseman?
Yes.
Right? You know what I mean? So does it really change that much?
Well, but what type of defenseman do you think you need?
I would still be looking for another top four guy.
A right-handed top
four
guy?
Now, I guess the rebuttal would be, okay, but does it have to be a good puck mover
Are you paying the premium to get a right-handed guy? Does the equation of what you're willing to pay, is that altered if you're like, yeah, you know what? Susie, Brännström, hey, maybe neither's our perfect three,
mm-hmm.
but maybe if we have 2 4-5s, we can do what we did last year where we have two, like, elite third pairs,
mm-hmm.
and we can cobble together these safe minutes where we are still able to control mm-hmm. play.
But see, to me, that would always be plan B. Now, I guess it's like a plan B you feel more comfortable going with if the prices are too high, right? If you get that information.
Well, the prices are too high.
Right now they are. We'll see how it develops.
Period.
Right, but like they don't want to pay them now. There might be a situation where they want to pay them closer to the deadline.
Especially if they...
if the team performs right,
gear,
all those things. Yeah, exactly, right? But to me, it's always going to be a plan B. Like, the ideal would be, hey, we tried Brännström in second pairing minutes. It worked. That's great. Now we're going to move him back down to the third pair because we went out and acquired a guy that we think is going to fit really well with Carson Soucy. You know what I mean?
Yep.
That still would be plan A. Maybe you feel a little bit more comfortable, but it's hard for me to envision, just knowing what Rick Tocchet likes on a blue line, how this management group has typically gone about assembling their blue line, it's hard for me to picture Erik Brännström in a no doubt about it top four role going into the playoffs. That's like, I think his performance would have to be exemplary for the remainder of the season for that to be the case.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right.
Now, maybe it's not beyond him. Maybe he can do it, but it's like, that's a very high bar.
Simply for size reasons.
Exactly.
It's just,
he's not the archetype.
He's not the archetype
that they want. And that's a hard thing to overcome for a player.
He's not the archetype for this coaching staff.
Exactly.
Okay. But I think there's more open-mindedness on this management team, right? Like,
that's fair.
And not just about Brännström in particular, but I think in general about what blue liners can accomplish, right? Like, remember the Rutherford model of winning Stanley Cups. involves Justin Schultz as 1A mm-hmm. guy in Chris Letang's absence. It involves that Carolina defense where the only name you remember is Frantisek Kaberle, and you only remember him because of his older brother.
Tomas Kaberle's brother, yeah.
So I'm just saying, like, that's the model, right? The model is like, yeah, it's not perfect. So they're defensemen, right? Like, that's the model.
Yeah, that's fair.
And I think there's an understanding and an openness, at the very least, at sort of the highest levels of Canucks hockey operations decision-making, that Brännström has the competitiveness to maybe make it work. I think the club has to see it. That's where I'm at. That's just my personal view.
Look, I have no problem trying it out.
And I think
there's nothing wrong with trying it out. And I'm just skeptical how much it changes their ultimate opinion.
But again, maybe not as much for the coaching staff. But I think for management. But I think for the people pulling the triggers on trades, there's a belief that Brännström can maybe do more.
Yeah, and this text comes in. I think it's more about, do you need to get two defenders instead of one, right? If Brännström is one already kind of in-house, then maybe a little more focused. Because I agree with that.
The club's not out on Myers and Soucy.
I think like pre-Brännström really establishing himself, I was looking at and saying, like, I expect them to go get two defensemen. That's kind of how I was thinking. You know what I mean? And if Brännström kind of takes care of that, at least in even a depth role. You know what I mean? And I get where the texture's coming from. Maybe at least a little bit of their work is done already.
Sure.
With Brännström establishing himself as an option. Okay, we're going to take a break here. Yannick Hansen joins us on the other side, former Canuck. Lots to get into with Yannick, as always. So we'll talk to him next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Reminds me of the saxophone Squirtle music. That's the vibe I'm getting there. Anyways, welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Trantz. We're live from the Kintech studio. Kintech, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? And we are now very pleased to be joined on the line, former Canuck regular contributor here on Sportsnet 650. He is Yannick Hansen. Yannick, thanks for doing this. How are you?
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm good. How are you guys doing?
We're doing very well. So the Canucks are in Boston, getting ready to play in just a few hours here. Brock Besser making his return to the lineup, of course, after missing time after that Tanner Jeannot hit in L.A. What's it like for a player coming back mid-season after missing a little bit of time, you know, first game back? And Brock's talked about it. You know, he knows he's going to have to kind of find his legs. What's that return game like for a player in these circumstances?
It all depends on length you're away, obviously. It's not too long, so it's not like he's completely removed. But it's never easy to jump in back in because it's 100 miles an hour, and you've been sitting on idling now for, what is it, 2-3 weeks ago since he got hit. And again, that specific injury is a little bit different coming back from too, because you're healthy again, you're ready to play, but you don't want to get hit again, because it's not fun. You just come over top of all of it, whether it's headache, whatever it is, you're not feeling right. It's not like when you break a leg. It hurts, and eventually it gets better. The head is it's a different animal, and you're a little more hesitant, a little bit more worried about the next one coming up. So it is a matter of how much can I take as well. Obviously, you can't shy away, but even a legal body check, if you will, the first 2, 3, 4, 5 before you realize, okay, I can take these without having any kind of repercussions, you're thinking about a little bit different. So again, you hope that he can step back in, have a good game, no episodes, no issues whatsoever. And like I said, the leg should still be there in terms of him only having been out a couple of weeks now. But it's never easy to come back from an injury.
Yannick, I'm curious. you had some seasons in Vancouver where everything sort of rolled downhill for the team and everyone was producing. And obviously there's, you know, divots and challenges inevitable over 82 games. But sort of you get to the end and everyone's had a pretty good season or a very good season. And you also were, you know, a Canucks player for like the torts season where, you know, no one produced, no one scored goals. The season became a drag. There was sort of off ice dysfunction. When you're in that, and this Canucks season seemed to be so complicated just in terms of injuries. And I mean, even the bad luck misconduct for Quinn Hughes the other night, Miller's leave of absence. I mean, Demko's unprecedented injury. You've had players' parents passing away and on like, it's just seemed endless. When you're in that as a player, is it tough to deal with? Like, are you aware that you're sort of going through it as a group while it's happening?
You always feel like you have bad luck. Then you start looking around the other teams, and it happens to every team.
Yeah,
that's why you guys keep hearing this next man up mentality, because it's really the only thing you can do. Next guy coming into the lineup just has to fill a role. He doesn't necessarily have to fill the boots of the guy that went out on the other end, because when Quinn leaves, when JT leaves, when Brock left, you're not going to find those players in the minors to step in. So it's got to be done by committee. But the guys who do step in, they got to come in and fill some sort of void. Like, we don't expect Saxon or Baines or Ratu or any of these guys to come in and lead the power play and score all the goals. No, they got to come in. They can't hurt the team. Got to give you 10, 12, 13 solid minutes, and then hope that you find the scoring like you did in Ottawa, where like you're looking at that lineup, and especially after Quinn goes down, it's like, oh no, where is this going to come from now? And again, it came from the guys you were expecting, DeBrusque, Kiefer, and Petey, that line. They produced, Garland was in there as well. So it came from the usual suspects, if you will, the ones you kind of expected or were hoping would step up in the absence of all these players. But that being said, you need the rest of the lineup to come in to give you good minutes. Don't get buried. Don't hurt the team. Don't get scored on too much, because then we don't have a chance to win the game. So it is very much, it is cliche, but it is really just next man up, and hopefully these guys that are on the shelf eventually to come back, and we're that much better for it.
Yeah, that Pettersson line with DeBrusque and Sherwood, really good in Ottawa, and they've been good for a few games in a row now together, producing, doing a good job of controlling play. When you got put into a new combination, a new line, could you tell kind of right away, okay, this has a chance to work, we have chemistry? Was it sometimes obvious that, hey, we've got a real chance to click and be a good group here?
I kept telling the coaches, I'm really good with the twin, but for some reason it took forever to get there. No, it is style. Style sometimes matches, and now we look at this line you're mentioning. There is nothing with these three that screams they should work together.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times you have tandems in the league, two guys who gel really well, and then that third guy can be a different type of player depending on what they finish. And that's what we were hoping for. You were hoping that Petey and DeBrusque would kind of form the JT Miller of and Brock Besser does on the other line, and then find another guy. And Sherwood, the way he plays, every top line will love have a guy like that on your line. Not just right now, he's obviously scoring, producing, it's a bonus, but he does so much dirty work, forechecking, finishing checks, keeping D's honest, all of these things that are tiresome, tedious, that takes away from your skill and all that stuff. When you have a guy like that on your line, you're like, okay, he's going to get in first. I dump the puck. I know he will get there. He will get it back for me. Now my skill will hopefully come through. So it's one of those things where sometimes you need the right mix, and then they don't necessarily have to be the similar type of players in order to gel. Like I said, Sherwood have been playing well all year. It doesn't really matter which line he's been on. Right now he's producing, which is a huge boost, but he plays the same way no matter if he's on the first or the fourth line. He's going to crash and bang. He's going to cause a little bit of disruption here and there, keep guys looking over their shoulder when he's on the ice. When you get a guy like that scoring as well, now he becomes very hard to play against, because now you're not just worried about when Petey's on the ice, okay, we just got to make sure you don't get scored on. Now he might also get run, So it creates another aspect to a line, which makes you a little bit harder to play against.
With Sherwood in particular, when you went up with the Twins after your years of lobbying finally paid off, Yannick, you know, I know you've talked before about like the fitness aspect, right? That was one of the most challenging parts, even for a pro athlete. But when you get a shot as a player like a Sherwood type to complement skill players, guys who've, you know, regularly scored 25 goals like DeBruskin, guys who've had 100 points like Pettersson, how do you have to approach it mentally? What's the challenge, I suppose, to sort of rising to that occasion?
Yeah, that's the hardest thing, the pressure that comes with it. Because we all love skating around in the third line. Nobody really after you if you don't score. If the team loses, it's not your fault. you get a chance there. And when you played with the Twins, you were going to get one or two opportunities, grade A opportunities, not like the one I would get on the third or fourth line where you're coming off the wing and you're taking a slapper for a rebound and crash and bang, maybe you get a tip or something like that. You're going to get a chance in the high slot, on the back door, on a two-on-one, almost every single game. If you don't score in those chances, that is oftentimes the difference between winning and losing. And that's where the pressure comes in. And that ties into the mental part where you're already before the game starting, you're stressing now as a third line player, I got to score. I got to produce. We got to win our matchups. If we don't, it's my fault. Petey's done it for a number of years. DeBrusk has done it for a number of years. I have not. If they don't score, it's my fault. It isn't, but that's what's going through your head, because if you don't score, it's not the other two that's going to get demoted or switched around. No, it's you. That's the biggest hurdle. That's the hardest thing to deal with, that thing, making sure you are producing, you're on, you're carrying your play every single night. And again, it's hard to play in the NHL at the best of times, but playing in those situations, given that responsibility, it weighs on players. There's no question about that. So the biggest thing, yeah, of course, you're going to get more minutes, which is tiring and taxing and all those things. But it's in your head at night, in the morning when you wake up and before the puck is dropped. It's going through your head that you got to produce, you got to score.
Yeah, and I think that mental adjustment you're talking about to moving up the lineup, Yannick, is really interesting, because I think sometimes we see, right, a player from the bottom six who's developed a certain identity, plays to a certain role, they get moved up the lineup and maybe they lose some of that identity that made them successful in the bottom six. One of the impressive things about Sherwood is he's not just complimenting Pettersson and DeBrusk offensively and producing, he's still bringing that energy, those hits, that physical game that made him successful as a bottom six player. How difficult is it to do that? Right, to step up and say, okay, I'm in a position where I can be more offensively impactful, but at the same time make sure you're still doing all of the energy stuff and the identity stuff that he has been so good at.
Yeah, and that's oftentimes the problem, because now you're playing 5 minutes more a night, and it is very, very hard, and it's very taxing finishing your checks. It drains you. So when you're playing that 10 to 12 minutes, you don't really have to worry too much about offense. Obviously, if you get opportunities, it's great. But you're dumping the puck and you're finishing your check and then you're cycling. And that's kind of the name of the game. Now you're going to get more chances, more opportunities. You got to carry the play. We can't just get rid of it and finish our checks, because Petey and DeBrus don't want to play like that. They want to play with the puck. They want to get in. They want to cycle. They want to create scoring opportunities. So you get sucked away a little bit away from that identity you have, if you will. Some intentional, different players, more minutes. Some unintentional, because you're not used to playing all these minutes. So you got to save yourself a little bit. So you have jam in the third period as well. And the way you save yourself a little bit is maybe I swing off this check and I don't finish it because my legs will be a little bit better. But then now your game starts to suffer. So it's a very fine line where you got to find a way to continue playing the same way that has made you successful. But now you got to do it more, longer, harder, and all of these things. So it is always a challenge when you jump around in the lineup, because different players, different style, different situations, and still you got to be you.
Yannick, there's a rush in this market now when a player has success the way Sherwood has on the top line over the past couple of weeks to drop the Alex Burrows comparison. I just wanted to get your take on this since you had a front row seat to watch what Burrows accomplished with the Twins all of those years. Do we have to have a higher bar for dropping that comp?
I think you media love the comparison, fans love the comparison, because oftentimes it comes when younger players you don't know, and you're trying to describe who are these players, who could they potentially turn out to, and you drop everybody that are so recognizable. Oh, it's going to be the next Kessler. Oh, it's going to be the next Burrows. And again, to chances of finding them, like the chances of becoming an NHL player is minuscule. The chances of you turning into those players are even smaller. Burr is the outlier there in terms of coming out of nowhere. Kess, you kind of anticipated first round draft pick, hype, all of these things, and then turned out to be the player you obviously hope for. You obviously get lucky that he's above and beyond, but again, finding that so-called diamond in the rough, it almost never happens, because again, it is so well scouted. Players are looked at a younger age, so it becomes harder to find those players that come out of nowhere and become bona fide top line wingers for numerous years. It's easy enough to do it short stretches here, but scoring 30 consistently year after year, being a difference maker, it requires something special that nowadays it's almost always found beforehand, and then the player turned into who you thought they would be. So again, it's nice to do it from a fan perspective, because people that don't know these players, who is this player? Well, we all know Burr. Okay, he plays like Burr. He's gritty. He gets to the front of the net. He can finish a little bit. Does that mean he turns into a 30-goal scorer who will slay the dragon and have his name in the round? No, it does not. But it is nice in terms of style. But then again, there's obviously got to be a big gap there between, okay, he plays like him or he is like him, so to speak.
Yannick, what do you make of this team, just generally speaking? They clearly have a high floor. They've been able to still get results despite a variety of absences and, really significant ones, right? Their top goaltender, 40-goal scorer, 100-point two-way ace forward who's been their top minutes guy over the years. On the other hand, it feels like we've seen a lot of slow starts. I don't know that we've seen a lot of signature performances. Like, it does sort of feel like there have been games where they're maybe not playing the right way up to their own standard. I think that's the feeling internally, too. What do you make of what you've seen so far?
First part is obviously the depth. The team is deeper, especially on forward, than it's been in a long time. You have quality throughout the lineup now. The problem is now you have quality throughout the lineup. We're missing the high-end skill right now because it's been sitting in the press box, JT, Brock, Demko, and stuff like that. But you still have, in all fairness, you have nine middle six forwards. So the drop-off isn't that significantly there. We're just missing the high-end skill, the goals you can kind of count on. And that's why you can keep ebbing out these wins. Missing guys because you have enough talent. When push comes to shove, you're going to need the talent because we all know scoring will go away and power play will become key. And those players that produce and are counted on to produce, they have to produce for you. And if they don't, well, then your playoff is over in a hurry. So regular season, you can kind of get away from it. That being said, we are missing Quinn Hughes, JT have had those performances. I'd say Quinn pretty much the entire season have been who he has and who we expect him to be, which is a Norris Trophy defenseman. But you're missing Petey. And he's come along later. The problem for Petey is his floor, if you will, is so obscenely high that he almost has to dominate every game or he's not playing up to the potential we're expecting him to. And again, that's great to have, but it also means you'll always have that coming after him, even when the team is winning, even when they're sitting in a good position. Well, you're not leading the team in scoring. You're not in the conversation of the top four or five centers in the whole league. And that's kind of where we want him to be. And when he gets to there, then we won't have these conversations because they will roll over teams. And then we will have these marquee matchups against the other contenders, Edmonton, Vegas, when Devils comes in or Carolina, whoever is on the East, where you say, okay, this is a statement game. Now let's see what we're made up of when the best is on their best and we're at our best. Right now, you will be able to get away with winning enough games to get into a playoff spot. The Pacific isn't that strong. It seems like it's kind of almost broken in half with Edmonton, LA, Vegas, and Vancouver. Calgary is hanging in there, but again, based on personal, assuming it's a question of time before the losses start to become a little bit more and it will fall apart a little bit. So you should be able to get in there playing okay hockey, but that's not enough. As soon as you hit round one, when your first round of permanent opponent then will be Vegas or Edmonton.
On the blue line, Yannick, we were talking earlier in the show about Eric Brandstrom, and he's been a really pleasant surprise for the team, drawing into the lineup and helping them move the puck. You know, it's always tricky with somebody who, a player who succeeds on the third pair in third pair minutes, and sometimes when you move them up to the top four, the performance doesn't look as positive. But have you seen enough from Brandstrom that it's at least worth trying, in your view, to play him a little more minutes and maybe even a top four role here?
The problem on his is the defensive part of the game, I think. You're sheltered on the third pairing in terms of who you see there. You don't see top six, or you shouldn't. You should be able to find the bottom six forwards to play against your third pairing there, which means it's a little easier. They play a different style. They don't carry. They don't expose you. They don't take chances. You don't get caught and stuff like that. So it's one of those things where guys look good in places they need to be. As soon as you get moved out of that comfort zone, now you're going to get exposed. Now you're going to end up in your own end against guys that are bigger, faster, and more skilled than you, and then you end up in trouble. So again, he's been a phenomenal at, don't get me wrong. We're lucky to have him and kind of like a throw in there. And he's solidified himself in the lineup and have produced a little bit. So everything that really comes from him in that role is a plus. There's no question the organization needs another D. They need somebody to play on the second pairing, preferably with Susie, and then have Myers and Brandstrom on the third pairing. But because that is the glaring hole right now, after Quinn Hughes and Hronek, Susie and Myers haven't been the answer. Desharnais and forward, when they're in there, aren't that either. So you need somebody who can carry that pairing, and then everybody will be better for it.
Last one for you, Yannick. I mean, Nils Höglander, at the start of the season, coming out of training camp, looked like he'd put himself in a really good position to play some significant minutes. You know, even in the early part of the season, right? He was producing and he was playing, you know, 17 minutes a night some games. And since then, he's kind of found himself back in the doghouse a little bit, playing in a bottom six role. Looks like he's going to be on the fourth line tonight. And I think we've started to see some frustration creep into his game, some penalties he's probably not too happy with. When you're in that situation, you know, he's still a relatively young player, although he's played a lot of NHL games. Like, how do you kind of dig yourself out of whatever's going wrong for Nils Höglander at the moment?
He needs to figure out who Nils Höglander is. And again, he is, by all means, I hope he proves me wrong, but he's not a top six forward. He has the jam. He has the tenacity. He has all the skills and abilities to play in this league for a dozen years, if he chooses to. But he has to find a way to be that third-line winger, be the one that can kill penalties, be the one that produces 30, 40 points consistently every year without the power play time, win your matchups, be a pest, draw penalties, because he does play an annoying style, heavy on the forecheck. He throws these sneaky, heavy hits that catches guys off. But then he gets away from it a little bit. He starts wanting to produce. I've scored in the past. I scored in Sweden when I played there. I should be scoring here. And now that game kind of disappears. It's almost like we talked about Sherwood earlier, where go out, play your style, the points will come, and then will your opportunities as well. And then he's one of those players that you can throw into the top six to mix it up in a third period for a game here and there when guys are missing. But he needs to carve himself a spot on that third line and be that one that when July, August, September rolls around, the wingers on the third line are penciling. It's Höglander, no question. We know where he's going to be. Then we got to fill the under spot, and then he will be successful, I think. Too much jumping around, too much tweener business is not good for anyone.
Yannick, appreciate the time. As always, enjoy the game tonight.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
That is Yannick Hansen, former Canuck, joining us here on Canucks Talk and weighing in on what he's seeing from the team right now.
I need to do a little bit of a show some respect to Alex Burrow's rant on the other side, too.
That's fair. I did want to ask him, and we moved away from it, though, and I'd be fascinated to know, maybe we can get into it another time, like, what was Yannick's internal reaction, honest internal reaction, when he saw Burrows going up with the Sedins? Was it, oh yeah,
ooh,
you know what I mean? Or was it, where's AV going with this?
They were on a 10-game losing streak.
Yeah, I know.
So
it was probably just like, well, you got to try something.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
I would be shocked if it was any different than that. Was Hansen fourth liner then?
That's a great question.
Because it was the Sundin year, right? So 09-10, was he a full-timer that year? I don't think he was. I think that was the year that he led the Manitoba Moose in scoring.
You can check. Sundin was 08-09.
Oh, okay. So that's
so
the
it was
season.
After.
So 08-09. I think yeah. That's the season that he led the Manitoba Moose in scoring.
Okay.
That was his, like,
but I think
breakout American.
Yeah,
League
so
year.
And that was the year that Burrows won the Sedins. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So he probably wasn't even on the team. There you go. But maybe from afar. He was like, what?
I'm sure he was excited. Like, hey, I can do this.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's go.
Paves away for me. All right, we'll take a break. We can talk about Alex Burrows.
You know what would really be a mean move, by the way, is if Dom started playing us off with jazz as opposed to this, like, Disney.
As opposed to the Oscar music?
Well, I mean, it is Oscar music, but doesn't it also sound like
yeah,
the music?
It's like classic Disney animation feel
yeah,
to
it's
it.
Like,
yeah,
it's like.
Before I went woke?
Yeah, like lovable Disney character at the market. That's what this song is. You know, like, look at this world of wonder. Can I get some fresh bread? Whole town starts singing.
No, it sounds more like the end credits music to me.
No,
this is the conclusion.
No, this is whimsical market trip.
Flying through clouds.
Yeah.
Approaching the house of the main character.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. That's great. We'll talk about Alex Burrows. Maybe we'll hear from Rick Tockett next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. That's why they call Dom the Scat Man.
This is me while I'm driving aggressively
right.
Around town.
While you're cutting Drance off.
Scat Man Dom.
Happily scatting in your car.
Scat Man Dom.
I actually drive a Toyota Scat.
Do you?
No.
Yeah, this is a no for me.
Absolute no.
I like jazz. This is a no for
this
me.
This is such a no.
This is a no.
This is Dom cutting someone off on the highway.
Anyways, welcome back to Canucks Talk here, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. We're live from the Kintech Studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. And I forgot to mention, our insider, Yannick Hansen, in the last segment, brought to you by the Magnuson Auto Group, Metro Ford, Port Coquitlam, and Magnuson Ford in Abbotsford, on both sides of the Fraser to serve you. And one of the things we talked about with Yannick Hansen was the Kiefer Sherwood performance, but then also the inevitable is Kiefer Sherwood, the new Alex Burrows conversation, which I don't want to say it took the market by storm this week, but it kicked off. It popped up this week for sure after his strong run of outings with Elias Pettersson. And look, you said you wanted to do a bit of a rant on the respect owed to Alex Burrows.
Yeah.
And I'll just say this. Alex Burrows was my favorite player. I loved Alex Burrows. Yeah, he was rocked. Awesome. So much fun to cheer for. So much fun to watch. Like, I could talk about Alex Burrows all day. So we just go for it.
We just cannot and should not do the Burrows. Is this guy the next Burrows after two really strong weeks? We can't do it. Like, the thing about Alex Burrows is he became a fixture on that line, right? And produced not well, but at an elite rate, mm-hmm. right? Like, that three-season run, 2009-10 through 2011-2012.
Yeah.
Fifth in the NHL in five-on-five goals. Sixth in the NHL in five-on-five goals. The only five guys that scored more, Marian Gaborik, Bobby Ryan, the greatest goal scorer of all time, Alex Ovechkin, and, Steven Stamkos, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we're talking about a who's who of the absolute best in the league, and Alex Burrows, and he did it for 3 years in a row. Like, do you know an NHL player that has a chance to be in the Burrows conversation in a couple years?
Who?
Zach Hyman.
Mm.
Okay, we're talking about that level of accomplishment, and then you have to sustain it. And the big difference there is Hyman ate on the power play. Like, Hyman's a perfect net front guy, right? That's why he got to 50. Burrows was a 30-goal guy because he ultimately, too, it wasn't just a usage thing. He wasn't particularly good as a stationary attacking player.
Sure.
He really wasn't. But 5-on-5, you know, with the defensive game and with the way that he could go to the net and the way that – and he had the same thing as Hyman, too, where – because Hansen will talk about it, where he – when he first went up with the Twins, one of the biggest challenges was they take these long shifts. You have to win every battle playing with them, right? And you have to play 20 minutes a night, right? Like, it was demanding physically to a point that even pro athlete Yannick Hansen wasn't prepared for
mm-hmm.
when he first took on the role. That's what Hyman does that's special. That's what Burrows had that was special. It's freakish. Like, it's, you have to become this, not even just like a great NHL player, but one of the fittest NHL players on the planet to play night after night with those guys. And that's what, you know, Burrows was able to do. So, and moreover, because the Twins played 400 minutes with a bunch of line mates, with Yannick Hansen, with Zach Cassian, with, you know, a variety of different players, of Brock Besser, Mikael Granlund over the years. Burrows made them better defensively by a lot. Like, he had his own impact
mm-hmm.
on that line. Would he have been top five in the NHL in 5-on-5 goals without the Sedins? No.
No, of course not.
But he made that line better materially. And that's, you know, something here that also has to be discussed.
Well, and he was just such an incredibly well-rounded
yes.
player, right? Because the thing that's always stood out to me for Alex Burrows, and it's no surprise here, I'm not breaking new ground, right? But just the trajectory of his career and the way he so consciously and intelligently added the next thing, right? At every step, right? Because he comes up and I think people think, okay, yeah, he was a defensive specialist right away. Like, when he came up and started playing for the team, it was a pure pest role. Fourth line, go be super annoying, go get under their skin, be a pest.
Matt Cook style.
Then he graduated to, okay, well, now you're a defensive shutdown player, right? Now you're on our third line with Kessler. Now we're going to deploy you against other teams' top lines. You can still be a pest, but you're not just that, right? Then he starts adding, like, hey, you're a shootout option for us now because you've added that move to your repertoire. And then obviously he goes up with the Twins and proves he can be a great complement to them. And I remember even, like, you know, he never clicked on the power play, but basically every other facet of the game, he was a key player for them. And I remember even hearing, you know, Alain Vigneault talk, like, yeah, if we were ever down a defenseman and needed to play a forward on the blue line, it would be Alex Burrows, right? He was just like, he was like, literally, whatever problem we throw at him, he's so smart and thoughtful about it and hardworking, he's going to figure out a way to contribute. And I'm not saying Kiefer Sherwood can't do any of those things, right? But, like, Burrows did it, and he did it at a really high level for really, really good teams. We think of him as the twin sidekick. That was his best role, his most impactful role. But, man, he was good at a lot of other things in his own right, too.
And so for me, too, it's like Sherwood's a nice story. He leads the team in 5-on-5 offense at this point in the season, which is incredible. I buy, and I've bought really since they signed him, that there's offensive upside there, right? Like, I didn't think it was it was a day after free agency that I was reporting that the Canucks had interest in seeing what he looked like with Elias Pettersson, and we weren't making fun of it. Like, I think the team was too sheepish to say it publicly, to be totally honest with you. But it's true. Like, that's honestly something that they thought would work right off the hop. And it has. Like, it has. And there's a real chance that he can stay in a more prominent role than any of us would have drawn up, maybe except for, is it Sat or Dan Riccio?
I think it's both of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, but mostly Sat, maybe.
Right. Than anyone but Sat had sort of anticipated at the outset of the season. Like, I buy all that. But you have to do it, and you don't just have to do it once, right? Mm-hmm. You don't just have to do it for 2 weeks. You have to do it for 82 games. And then you have to do it for another 82 games.
You know what the other thing is?
And then you have to do it for another 82 games. And by the end of it, we have to say, not only did you produce at an elite clip and become a fixture at the top of the lineup, but your impact made the star player more imposing, better. You improved them. Like, you have to have all of that in place.
I think you also have to do it for a really good team over that stretch.
Right.
Like, that's a huge part of this as well, right? That he was instrumental not just to putting up points, he was instrumental to them being one of, you know, the team with one of the best records in the NHL over that stretch. Like, that's a huge part of the reason why Alex Burrows is remembered as fondly as he is, the reason why he's in the Ring of Honor, right? Which, as we've discovered, can be a hard place to crack now for the Canucks. Alex Burrows is there. And the team record of success during his time and his peak, especially when he was playing with Daniel Henrik Sedin, is a big part of this. So I think you're absolutely right. Obviously, you cannot, you know, 2 weeks into Kiefer Sherwood playing with Elias Pettersson and having success, you cannot say he's the new Alex Burrows. Obviously, you understand where the comparison is coming from. And the thing that stands out to me is I do sense some of that recognition from Sherwood. He understands what he needs to do to complement Elias Pettersson I'm willing to say at a really good level right now. Obviously, Burrows was just elite at that, understanding exactly what he needed to do to help the Sedins, to make them better, to be in a position to capitalize on the scoring chances. And I think you can see a little bit of that from Sherwood, right? And we were talking about it with Yannick Hansen, where he understands he has to maintain the energy, he has to do the dirty work on the forecheck, bring the speed, all of those things. But then he's also got to get open and let it rip, right? Let it rip as soon as it's on his stick when Elias Pettersson passes him the puck. And I think it's hard to have kind of both of those ideas in your head at the same time. That's what stood out to me the most about Kiefer Sherwood is that, and again, there's a little bit of a Burrows thing there, right? Like, building elements on top of your game without sacrificing the other things. I think that's really hard to do, and we're seeing the beginnings of it with Kiefer Sherwood. But as you said, like, what Burrows did was just absolutely incredible. Man, if Kiefer Sherwood turns into that for this team, that would be quite the development. Then we can really talk about the pro scouting success of the Canucks after that.
Yeah. No, look, this is absolutely not even a Sherwood take. It's just we have to raise the bar before comparing guys to franchise greats. I feel strongly about it.
Yeah. No, he's in the Ring of Honor. He's a... I don't know. Great. Yeah, that's probably fair.
Yeah, franchise
legend, franchise icon. Like, he's a hugely significant player for this franchise. So,
yep.
It's aspirational. I get it. But
it's just way too early. Way too early.
Alex Burrows was so great.
Unbelievable.
What a treat. What a treat to watch he was. 650.
Canucks talk. Big Alex Burrows slappies on this program.
Absolutely. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. You can send your thoughts in as well. I know we didn't talk for a long time, but do we have Rick Tocchet audio good to go? No, nothing? Okay, well, we'll see if we do get some thoughts from Rick Tocchet here. Team had an optional game day skate, and, you know, with not a lot of media traveling anyways, we're not getting a lot of tips on lineup construction. Based on how they practiced, it looks like it'll be Sherwood with Pettersson and DeBrusque still, as well as Brock Besser going with Dan Heiner and Teddy Bluger. In fact, we do have some Rick Tocchet audio, so it's short, but here's a little bit of what the head coach had to say today.
Rick, we did see Brock Besser obviously in a contact jersey, and the hope was, I guess, to have him in the game today. Do we have any update?
Yeah, he'll play today. He's came to me yesterday, and, you know, he wants to play. So, you know, those situations... Obviously, when you're medically cleared, then it's the player's decision, I always think. And, you know, a guy like Brock, he wants to play every game. You know, he played a lot of hockey for us over the years. So it's good to have a guy like that in the lineup.
Yeah, you got a tight matchup tonight. Boston sitting in a very similar position in their division with 23 points as well. What will Brock add to this lineup for tonight's game?
Well, you're playing a Bruins team that's playing really tight. I think they've only let one goal in the last couple of games. always known as a good structured defensive team that plays a team game. So when you can add a guy like a Brock Besser, who doesn't need a lot of chances to score, it helps when you play a team that's really tight, plays tight defensively.
Are you hoping for a psychological boost as well? I know that try to keep guys focused on the next game, but in the back of people's minds, they know that you've got these key players out. Here's one coming back. Does it give the guys a lift?
Yeah. From my experience, you use it to your advantage, obviously, with a guy like Brock, but we still have to stay the identity of our team. Like we played a really smart hockey game in Ottawa. Things don't change because Brock comes in or we start getting guys back. We got to stay with identity. So that's really the message.
Is Max coming out?
Yes. And it's one of those things, and that's the hardest thing as a coach because he doesn't really deserve to come out. I thought he played a really good game. But the message to him is, he could go in the next game against Pittsburgh. That's the message, and he played a good game for us. I really enjoyed watching the way he played a team game, so stick with it. And that's really the message for guys like that.
That is Canucks coach Rick Tocchet, again, just weighing in on Brock Besser coming back into the lineup, Max Sasson coming out. But as Tocchet said there, hey, could be back in as soon as tomorrow when they play back-to-back against Pittsburgh. And we've talked about that, especially if you're looking to get some extra speed, some fresher legs in the lineup against the Pittsburgh Penguins, who are very vulnerable to speed this year, then maybe Max Sasson could be an option to draw back in. We talked about it a little bit with Yannick Hansen, and Yannick has been asked about Nils Höglander a lot over the years, right? People forget maybe, but Nils Höglander started 36. By wearing number 36, yep. Right? So there was a lot of like, how, what's that like for you, Yannick? Anyways, he's been asked about Nils Höglander a lot over the years. And I think it's safe to say we're at a bit of a lower ebb for Nils Höglander right now. Some of the penalties creeping back in, and even with JT Miller out of the lineup still, right, back down to the fourth line, hard to kind of see the path into a top of the lineup, top six, even top nine role right now for Nils Höglander. And it's the kind of thing where I understand what Yannick is saying, right? He needs to figure out how he's going to be successful, and maybe it is in more of that classic bottom six role. But at the same time, you just got signed to a three-year, $3 million AAV extension by the team. That doesn't necessarily scream like, hey, don't worry about scoring, right? You know what I mean? You're signed to that deal. There's a certain level, not elite production, but a certain level of production that comes with that.
Yeah.
When you sign that type of deal. So
sure. I think he isn't on the deal yet.
No, he's not, but yeah. He signed it.
Yeah.
Like it's not speculative, nope. Right? They're saying we're keeping you around for that length of time and we're going to pay you that much. And I think it's fair if you're the player to kind of inherently, like, implicitly learn or take from that there's a certain expectation about your production. But he seems to be kind of caught in a rock and a hard place right now.
Well,
and it's just also one of those things where it seems like nothing he's doing is working at the moment. And I think you can see the frustration creeping into his game.
Yeah. I mean, look, he's a very good player. He's a very good player. Mm-hmm. It has been rough, without question, in the... It's been rough. Like the last, 2 weeks? I mean, really, since he got removed from the top six.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know. Like, he needs to play better. But also, I do think he needs more opportunity. Hasn't even been, like, he's been getting some power play too, but not a ton of it. I do think it would benefit the Canucks to find a way to give him an opportunity again. You know what I mean? To find a way to play him with skilled guys. Like, look, Garland and Sherwood making it work with Heinen and Bluger, I mean, it's a big ask. Like, mm-hmm. It really is a big ask, right? Especially because, I think Bluger's played well this season. I don't know that Heinen really has.
That's fair.
He's dependable, right? Like, he's a dependable middle six guy, but probably shading toward the bottom six. And, I don't think where Höglander's game is at right now, he's a guy that can sort of drive for that line, but they're going to need him to. Like, they need him to get back to at least being, the spark plug offensive element that this team had last season. The other part of this is guy converted on 20% of his shots last year. He was never going to repeat that.
Mm-hmm.
The path forward for him needs to include holding down a larger role. And that's been, something that he hasn't been able to do through the first 20 games. So, simplify, win some battles, get back to being that high motor guy. You know, it does, he does feel like a guy that, man, if the dam broke and he could just get one, it feels like things would maybe rotate, but he's definitely a guy who just needs something positive here.
Yeah, and the point about, you know, he needs more opportunity, and I even think back to Rick Tocchet said they had that brief conversation, right, where Hoglander came to him and was like, hey, I can do better, and Tocchet was like, yeah, and I can find you more ice time, and neither guy has really kept up his end of the bargain, right? Like, Hoglander hasn't performed better. Perhaps accordingly, Tocchet has not found that ice time for him. It's tough, though, and I guess Heinen would be the clear guy, right? Do you try to build kind of an offensive third line that still has some defensive responsibility with Bluger and Besser and Hoglander, right, and put him in that situation? But I know we've had this conversation before as well. Like, with opportunity in the NHL, it's not so much about the team going out of their way to create those opportunities for you as much as it is you stepping up and demanding them.
Yeah, you got
to
earn them.
So in a crowded forward group, like the Canucks have now with Joshua back, right? With Kiefer Sherwood at least temporarily establishing himself as a top six fixture, it's going to be really hard for the coaching staff to carve out obvious, like, oh, wow, that's a really good spot for Nils Höglander to produce offense. But he's going to have to find a way to do something to produce, even with that roadblock in front of him.
Yeah, and look, Rick Tocchet can't afford to babysit right now. This team's scrapping for their life. Like, they're trying to... Not for their life. That's probably a little dramatic.
No, but
they need to hold the fort. They're in hold the fort season. When you're in hold the fort season, it's hard to do the... It's hard to do the
rebuild.
You
think the guys in the Alamo were thinking about stuff like this? No, they were focusing on holding the fort.
Custer was all like... Anyway, but the truth too is that I do think there's a carrot and a stick. And Hoglander, especially with what the organization's invested in him, and especially because this was a guy playing top 6 minutes until one bad back check. You know, it's not like there was a run of poor form.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, there wasn't.
Yep.
And so I do think in those circumstances, you know, as much as you got to hold the fort, you also got to think globally. And this is a guy who clearly just needs something positive to break his way. Now, he needs to make that happen too.
Yeah.
But you don't want this to linger, right? You don't want to get to like your 3 weeks. It's like 3-4 weeks and Hoglander's been struggling the whole time. And we're getting close to that point. Like, I do think,
yes.
I do think manufacturing something, even if it's second power play ice time, right? Which he's lost. Like, that's the sort of thing where I'd like to see them at least, you know, that's low leverage too.
Yeah, like, that's not like you're not bending over backwards, right? It's just a little thing that you can kind of do to maybe build some confidence back.
You know, if a game goes badly for you on this trip, right? Can you get him a couple shifts with Pettersson, right? Just like at the edges, looking for ways to give him a little bit of a carrot, I think would go a long way, especially if, you know, he doesn't have a positive result. Like, it might just happen organically. He might work his own way through it. But I do think finding some low leverage ways to give him some cookies might be helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, they obviously have a fairly high opinion of the player. I know you've talked a lot about, right, the requests for him in trade packages at the deadline last year and how much of a non-starter that was for the team. So I think the front office certainly will be very motivated to find the path forward, even if it's not a front burner issue for Rick Tocchet. And even with all the depth that they have, you know, a Nils Höglander who's rolling can still be a really significant weapon. And again, for this year, it might be that he settles into, you know, hey, he's your 9th or 10th most used forward once everyone's back. But even in that role, you want him as confident as he can be in that type of situation and producing as much as he can be in that type of situation. So again, it's not a front burner issue. It's just kind of lingering right now. But I think you make a good point where you want to nip it in the bud as much as you can. You don't want this to be a storyline 2 weeks from now, a month from now, right? When you're going into the new year, if Miller's back and minutes are even harder to find at forward, whatever they can do to kind of sort it out, whatever Hoglander can do to sort it out here in the near term, it's important. And maybe this road trip is a chance for him with the way the team has been playing better on the road so far this year. Okay, that's it for us today. As a reminder, Canucks taking on the Boston Bruins at 4:00. In just a couple of hours, you'll be able to hear it here on the station. Batch and Randeep with the call.
Hopefully they play structured hockey and don't formlessly noodle like jazz musicians on the ice at the TD Bank North Garden.
What would you say the most structured musical genre is?
Classical.
There's a fair amount of noodling in classical, to be honest. There is! You guys go listen to like a Chopin piano piece.
I was gonna say, you probably listen to Chopin and go, oh, just wait for the drop.
Just wait for the noodling.
There is!
Chopin, well, you know,
I'm not criticizing, I'm just saying, there's noodling.
That's famously why Chopin was known as Mr. Noodle.
That's right. That's where that comes from. All right, we'll wrap it up there. We're back tomorrow. Crossover Wednesday here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.